I'm at the Sock, and this is on the FU Network, powered by your support on Patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, Patreon.com/FU Network TV, and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. And now, here's your show.
Visionaires, a podcast that tracks the journeys of entrepreneurs who have found success and fulfillment by following their muse down the road less traveled. Hello and welcome to Visionaires. I'm Stephen Kersner. Michael Hainsworth is an avatar of the concept of risk equals reward. After excelling in the field of business reporting in radio and television, Michael saw the writing on the wall for traditional media and took a leap of faith, leaving his secure TV job with BNN Bloomberg to embrace the without-a-net opportunities of the internet. Literally millions of people now have the technological capability to produce internet content, but lack the requisite knowledge to make their businesses viable, unlike Michael, who applied his 30 years of broadcast experience in crafting stories to new media with great success for his company, simply titled Hainsworth Corporation. But even with his earned knowledge and skills, it wasn't a cakewalk to develop a business model that has succeeded where many, many others have failed. What's his secret? Let's find out. Thanks for joining us on Visionaires, Michael.
Thank you very much for having me. And I don't know why, but I'm happy to be here.
Well, there's an important trait, humility. So, Michael, you were on TV for, I don't even know how many years. It seems like, I don't want to date you, but you were on TV for many, many years on, giving us business news. So you're obviously somebody who's attuned to the pulse of business and to the challenges that face entrepreneurs. And
well, I thought you were going to say, so obviously you're important. Which I would have to correct you on that.
Oh, yeah. I've been in TV since I was 14. I know that it doesn't make you important. So I'm not fooled by that. So, Michael, you left television and you created a business of your own. Tell us a bit about it and tell us about the genesis, how the idea came to you, how it developed. Let's start with what was the moment when you decided, you know what, I'm going to go out on my own and I'm going to do my own business. What were the reasons? What were the motivations and so on?
The calendar, primarily. I looked at the calendar in November of 2017 and realized that 2018 was going to mark my 30th year in broadcasting, 11 years in radio and 19 years in television. And I thought, wow, 30 years is a milestone. But you know what's not a milestone is a pink slip at 31 years, at 32 years, at 35 years. As someone who's been in the business since 14, you know very well that she is a cruel mistress who will never love you as much as you love her.
Oh, and listen, a cruel mistress doesn't even begin. It's more like the people who ran the school in Oliver Twist.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so with that in mind, I thought, if you can walk away from this business with your head held high on your own terms, that's a win. Because almost nobody gets to leave the business. The business leaves them. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, with 30 years, you got into TV at 14. I got into radio at 17. And so I thought, before all of this hair is gray, I need to reinvent myself for the digital age, because mainstream media doesn't get digital.
Still don't.
Precisely. The time at which I left, which is now a little more than 2 years ago, mobile first was already a five-year-old concept. Yet the management within the media industry in which I operated had no idea how to capitalize on digital, had put no effort into it. I had gone down to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas to cover CES, that big industry event. But I didn't do it for CTV and BNN. I did it for my podcast, Geeks and Beats, because CTV and BNN didn't want to spend the money that year. And like the budget was like 10 grand. And if there's anything I've learned about television is when they say there's no money, that's not true. There's always money. There's just no money for you. Yeah. So I went down as a podcast and, with a microphone and a camera and did it all as a one-man band. And when I came back, they were upset with me. They'd never once asked me. So you went down to an event by yourself with nothing but a camera and a laptop with editing software. Tell us what you learned about that experience. Because prior to that, every time we would go down for BNN and CTV, we would go down with me, a producer, a camera person, an audio person, and a runner, five people. I replaced five people with one person, and their first question was, why didn't you ask permission to go down and cover it, as opposed to, what did you learn replacing five people with one? And of course, now in the world of COVID-19, that's exactly what they're doing. With the revenue decline that we've seen, not just over the last 2 years, but over the last decade, that's exactly the kind of thing that they're now making their reporters do in the business, is be your own camera person, be your own editor, and put everything together yourself. And I thought, I've been beating my head against a wall with these people for years that this is the future. So instead of waiting for them to catch up, I'm just going to go out and do it myself. And that's where we are today.
Okay. Now, when you were making this decision, I mean, it's great to get out on your own and to not have to kowtow to people who just don't understand that they are obsolete and the obsolescence is just waiting to grab them. That's frustrating. But at the same time, there's some level of comfort or security, I guess is a better word, in being employed by somebody else who has to worry about things like overhead and generating income and, you know, generating revenue and so on. So leaving that after 19 years in television and 11 years in radio, where you were somebody who didn't have to worry about those concerns, you just had to worry about, you know, being the best at what you do. Was there trepidation? Was there ever a second thought? Was there a fear when you finally did it?
It is the biggest crippling anxiety that I have. To your point, I didn't have to worry about where my next dollar was coming from when I was in mainstream media. I knew exactly what I needed to do every day at exactly the same time. While the news stories were always different and the opportunity to tell stories changed every day, the actual structure of my day was identical. I could tell you at precisely 11:19 a.m. what I would be doing at that point in mainstream television. Every single day, it was the exact same thing. I had to be working on this thing over here, and then in 20 minutes, I had to work on another thing over there, and I could just come in and do my job. And when I walked away from that, I walked away from that security blanket of knowing that the only thing I had to worry about was doing a good job. Now I have to worry about things like business development. I have to worry about client maintenance. I have to do the freaking accounting now, which, you know, like when my wife and I got together, one of the decisions we made was that she would handle, when it came to finances, the day-to-day, and I would handle the old and gray. Because I had my phone line cut off in my 20s, not because I couldn't afford to pay it, but just because I never got around to paying it. So she handles all of those day-to-day finances now because she knows that we didn't get the lights cut off. But now in this world, I have to flex muscles that atrophied over the course of the last 20 years of my marriage.
Sure. Or we're never there.
Precisely. And so project management and accounting are the two heavy weights are around my neck right now. The reality is that I've exchanged one stress and trauma in mainstream media for a different stress and trauma. But the big difference is that the new stress and trauma is one of my own creation, and it's my own responsibility for it. Okay. And that's the best thing that I could be doing for myself at this time in my life.
Okay, but I think what you're saying is something that all entrepreneurs who are listening can relate to, because entrepreneurs typically were creators. We think forward. We think about, you know, building the product that we're building. We put ourselves into it. We're constantly thinking about it. Even if it's just on the back burner in our brain, there's always a process that's happening. And so it's something that is, you know, it represents everything that we are in a way. And thinking about moribund things like accounting tends to be a bit of a drag on the rush we get when we think about the work we're doing. So it is, I think it's a common thing. I mean, I can relate to what you're saying about not, you know, you didn't pay the bill, not because you didn't have the money, but because you just didn't get around to it. Lord knows I've done that many times because I am swept away by the rush I get from new ideas, from implementing ideas, from making things tangible from the intangible. And so I think what you're saying is something we can all, you know, people are listening and nodding. How do you deal with that anxiety, that fear? How do you put that away in a sense so that it doesn't drag you down?
Two ways, and this is by and large a case of do as I say, not as I do, because I don't really have a solid track record of actually taking my own advice in this department. But I do know these things work because they've worked for me in the past. One, exercise. And it doesn't have to be substantial exercise. Literally getting out for a 30-minute walk through the neighborhood. Out in the air, whether it be the cold air of November or the 24 degrees feels more like 34 with the heat. That sort of thing is important to just be active physically, to get out and about. Because a bunch of things happen. We all know about the physiology of exercise, but there's, of course, that psychological component of it as well. That's not just thanks to the exercise, but it's thanks to the change of environment that gives you the ability to let your mind wander into different areas. And sometimes they wander into very inspirational areas. I found that to be very helpful. And then the other aspect of keeping that anxiety and stress at bay, you know, kind of like Hodor in Game of Thrones, holding that door back as the hands come grabbing through, is just doing the work. Having a project management system in place that keeps track of what needs to be done, what is being done, what has yet to be done, and what has fallen through the cracks. I use a system called Asana, A-S-A-N-A. And what it does is it's an app and it's a website and it's a project management system. So when I get a client and we've got a one big project, I mark, from point A to point B on the calendar what that's going to be, and then fill in all the little nitty-gritty details within it and come up with a system and a calendar and a schedule of events so that when I get up in the morning, I know exactly what I need to do every day. Because one of the biggest things that's missing is that knowledge that, well, it's 11:19, time to work on this aspect of my day. It's 11:43, now on to this thing. Being able to come in, sit down and go, okay, so what's on my plate today and have something helps ease that anxiety. The downside, of course, is that if you only do that on a spotty basis, it's inconsistent and you still have that high anxiety.
Interesting. I mean, you obviously are disciplined.
Not at all. That's my problem.
Okay, so you don't. So you have the software. You don't necessarily follow it. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. I've got 8 notifications on my phone I'm looking at right now from the Asana app, and I know that all 8 of those items aren't actually due today, but I just haven't gotten around to moving the dates in the calendar because the client went, yeah, no, we're going to wait for another month on that idea. No. So, like little things like that. It's something that I taught my daughter when she was quite young and homework started to become a thing. I expressed to her the importance of do the homework the moment you get home while everything's fresh in your mind. And that means that when the test day comes, you know the stuff already. You can just breeze through the review of that and get the homework out of the way. And if I just took my own goddamn advice often enough, I'd have less of that kind of stress. But she's figured that out and she's going to go through life so much more successful than I'll ever be because she's got that foundation that I never got when I was 13.
Well, I was the kind of student who would not even do my homework because I knew how to get around it the next day when they came to check. I learned very early the skills of learning how to work a system, and that's come in handy. But at the same time, they used to say, you're only cheating yourself. And I used to think, you think so. The lack of discipline in the sense of doing stuff that's unpleasant and I don't want to do, I never really learned. And that they're right. I was only cheating myself. I wish that I had had the gift that you gave your daughter of that kind of wise counsel and parenting. I mean, not that I'm faulting my parents. They didn't know anything about this. But I wish I had learned.
On the parent thing, I'll tell you this. You and I are of a generation where our parents were literally the first teenagers. Their That's parents true. Had no idea how to raise someone who at the age of 12 wasn't going off to the coal mines, but instead was going off to the chocolate shop, with his best girl kind of thing. And how do you raise a young man in that environment? That generation had no idea. And I think the present generation, your Gen Xer types, are really the first to have seen the negative impact of absenteeism parenting that our parents did for us. Like, do you remember the term latchkey kid?
I remember. I wasn't. My wife was one of those. I wasn't. My mother was at home all the time.
I was a latchkey kid, and at the time, that was just a thing. Now, you tell somebody, oh, yeah, my daughter's a latchkey kid, and they will think you have abused your child.
Well, yes. I think there's a great deal to be discussed about how parenting has changed, maybe not for the better in many cases, but you did give your daughter a great gift. My parents, all they knew was that I got good marks, and really that's all that mattered, you know, the end result. But of course, I was also working in television, volunteering at a cable station 40 hours a week when I was 14. So I guess they weren't worried about my industriousness. But I used to do book reports after reading the back of the book, you know, just, you know, and if you're good at it, you can get away with it. However, you really are only cheating yourself. And I wish that I had that discipline ingrained in me when I was younger, because I think that entrepreneurialism is an art. And there's the heart of an artist in every entrepreneur. And the heart of an artist doesn't want to think about the drudge work of accounting. We want to move to the next thing that gives us a rush. You know what you should be doing. And so you've got that as an advantage. And you've got a program that helps remind you. It's a useful technology. But of course, you have to implement it. And that requires discipline and being an adult and saying, okay, this isn't something I like doing. But in order to get to the thing I like doing, I got to do this. And when you're doing it on your own and you don't have, you're not working for a company that's going to cut you a check no matter what, you really have to, knuckle down even if when it's unpleasant. But let's go back to when you chose to leave your job. Did you, before you went, map out what you were going to do when you stepped out on your own?
Yes and no. Mostly no, insofar as if I knew then what I know now, I would have gone about it completely differently. And having said that, I went out with the intent of knocking on doors and talking to people about what's going on in their world. But to be perfectly straight, when I walked away, I fully expected the phone to ring and it to be a bank going, oh my God, you've left. We have to snap you up immediately. And I would land with another full-time regular job doing, you know, the kinds of things that need to be done in the corporate world, because I had given up on media as a thing, as a concept, as an idea that I'm going to change the world by reporting on bad things going on. I decided I'm throwing in the towel. I'm switching to the dark side, as they would say in the media business. But the reality was that I clearly hadn't spent the last 2 years listening to those guests that I would interview about the gig economy. And the reality was nobody was hiring full time anymore. Everyone was choosing instead to bring in outside experts on a contract basis. So I quickly had to pivot the idea of just landing a full-time job somewhere to having to reinvent myself as a guy who is an independent content creator. And because I had a lot of experience with Geeks and Beats, with my podcast, doing that kind of content creation and going off on my own, I felt confident that I could land those sorts of relationships. And the most interesting, the best lesson I got out of that was my first relationship was with the Toronto Stock Exchange. And I completely screwed it up. The way I screwed it up was largely tied to pricing power. When you interview entrepreneurs about the mistakes they make early in their career, the one that always comes up is pricing. When you've come up with a widget, a service, a product, something that you think the world wants, you have to figure out what to charge for that. And usually entrepreneurs make mistakes at the beginning in that department. And I was among them. My brain had always been focused on a 9-to-5, 40-hour work week type life. So when I realized that no one was going to hire me as a staff employee and that I could create this fabulous content for others without actually having to have a security badge at that company, I stepped back and went, okay, so how do I go about doing this? And that was kind of one of the best lessons that I learned was pricing power. I talked to the exchange the same way I would have talked to an employer. And that was, well, this is the project we want to do. These are the number of hours I think it's going to take. So I'm going to divide the number of hours I think it's going to, or multiply the number of hours it's going to take by how much I think I need to make on a per hour basis to live. And that's not the way you price projects in the media world. Right. You don't walk in and say, well, if I want to make $150 an hour, I'm going to charge them this. If I want to make $400 an hour, I'm going to charge them that. You don't say, I'll bill you on a per hour basis. You bill them on a per project basis. And because I was billing on a per hour basis, suddenly I was frantically trying to make up hours that I wasn't getting at the exchange. And so I spent all of this energy getting additional clients to make up for those. If the TSX only took 10 hours a week, well, where am I going to get the other 30 hours? So I was so focused on landing additional clients that I failed to maintain the relationship with the Toronto Stock Exchange. And that was one of the other big lessons that I learned through entrepreneurs that I had spoken to, and then of course had to learn the hard way myself, was that client relationship management side of the equation. Once you've landed them, you have to not only provide that service or product that you've promised, but you also have to be in there massaging that relationship and keeping them feeling good about you. And I thought my sole responsibility was to create good content. And so between that and the client not really feeling like I was there for them, they were not interested in renewing a relationship. And I had botched it on day one with the pricing, and then I had botched it on the final day by not maintaining that relationship with that client at the time.
Now, when you say that entrepreneurs make pricing errors, and look, I do this all the time in the sense that I'm very Canadian. I have years of experience, very successful experience. I have awards. I have everything else. And I still underprice for my services. I still undervalue my services because I just have this humility built into me to the point that it's become almost a toxic humility.
Let me suggest to you perhaps another reason why you have that problem.
Tell me.
Is you've been in the business since age 14. And back to that idea that broadcasting is a cruel mistress who will never love you as much as you love her. Mm-hmm. It's an industry that undervalues the people who create content in it. It's an industry that constantly tells you you're easily replaceable. Like my entire mainstream media career, I was told, listen, I got a stack of resumes on my desk. You could be out of here in a heartbeat, pal. So do what you're told, don't push back, and just accept it. And what that does is over time, that makes you feel like your contribution to this machinery that is mainstream media is insignificant. Whereas you have a skill set and a knowledge base that simply doesn't exist outside the doors of that television studio or that radio station or that newspaper operation. I am amazed at the number of people who exist in the world today who don't have my skill set. And what I mean by that is I thought everybody had a sense of proper grammar. I thought everybody knew how to tell a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Uh-huh. I thought everybody knew that you can't have four different font styles in one graphic. But these are actually skills, you know? Like the things that entrepreneurs and creators take for granted are the things that lead us to undervalue ourselves. And when you've got an entire machine in the form of mainstream media constantly telling you that you could be replaced in a heartbeat and that your work is not as valuable as you think it is, how could you possibly know how to value your time?
Well, I think that's definitely true. I've seen a lot of colleagues go through that. My experience was completely different in the sense that what I was doing was so unique to something only I could do that I actually had the ability, I had tremendous leverage because they couldn't just replace me. And I used that leverage quite a bit because what I was doing was something nobody else was doing and nobody else could come in and just do. So I had tremendous leverage. And I obviously, you know, and I did push back all the time, but when you're out and you're on your own and the only person you're pushing back against is yourself, because you can't push back against clients. You're in a place where gravity and the physics are completely different in a sense. And you're right though about entrepreneurs taking for granted that everybody just knows the things we know. I'm mentoring some people now on how to interview and how various things, marketing and so on. And I just start giving them information and I think, wait, this is something they didn't know. You know, and I realized, well, I know a lot of things that they don't know. It's like when I was at a YouTube conference with, you know, aspiring YouTubers. To give you a sense of the nature of the audience, when they started, they said, how many people here had to skip school to be here today? And I thought they were kidding. And other than me and my friend, who was roughly my age, everyone else's hand went up. So they were obviously much younger. But after, but in the breakout sessions, it was clear that they wanted to do videos. They just didn't really know what they wanted to say or if they had anything to say, and they didn't know what to do. And I had to tell them about telling stories. Yeah, I had to tell them about how, because the fact is, used to be when you and I were young whippersnappers. Well, if that's a term, we in order to get a show
on the trolley.
Yeah, you listen to something on the gramophone. In order to get on television, you had to, in my case, I created a show. So let's use me as an example. It's the only one I can speak to. You had to come up with something. Then you had to refine it to a point where you could take it to a broadcaster. And then you had to convince them that they should invest money in producing it and in broadcasting it and in marketing it. And so you really, by the time you went there, you had a product that was honed, that you knew what, you had a vision, you had something, because otherwise they wouldn't even open the door for you. And now it's the cart before the horse, in the sense that people can now record or broadcast live to a greater audience than we ever could as broadcasters, right. Working for a broadcaster. They can do that, but they don't necessarily know what they're doing. Just having the tools doesn't give you the ability to use the tools properly. I've got a bandsaw out front that a guy doing renovations for me is using. It's there. I know how to turn it on, but I don't know how to use it. I'll probably lose a limb.
But here's the most important thing, I think, that you would have told these kids. That was that you don't turn on the bandsaw unless you've got something to cut. You don't turn on a microphone unless you have something to say. And the democratization of media has been this remarkable double-edged sword. We have incredibly inexpensive hardware to make it possible to create this content. Like, just the fact that you and I are having this conversation right now, the way we are with the hardware we're using, when we first got into the business, that would have easily have been 10 to 40 grand worth of gear and probably four or five people to make sure it happened, and maybe three or four conference calls before we actually had this conversation.
Well, there would have been a truck parked out front with a satellite dish on top of it.
Right. And we don't have to deal with any of that anymore. So it's so much easier to create content now, but the signal-to-noise ratio has gotten so bad because people are turning on a microphone before having something to say. One of the things I love about the digital media world versus the mainstream media world that I left was that not only do you turn on a microphone only when you've got something to say, but you turn off that microphone once you're done. When I was in mainstream television, I would have a guest come in, sit down across from me. We would allocate 7 minutes for a conversation. But what if I got through that conversation with that person in 5 minutes and got everything I needed to get out of them in those 5 minutes? Well, in traditional broadcasting, you have no choice but to continue for two additional minutes. So you get 5 minutes of gold and 2 minutes of fishing, desperately trying to find something else interesting to talk about. And you're wasting the viewer's time. Whereas if you had just turned off the microphone when you were done, you would have given that viewer everything that they needed, and then you could move on. You couldn't do that in mainstream television without a mass panic in the control room as 2 minutes before the end of an interview, you went, well, Joe Blow, thanks for joining us. That was Joe Blow. And suddenly, oh, Jesus, where are we going next? Kind of thing. So you have the ability to teach these kids that just because you have a camera and a microphone doesn't mean you should use it.
Well, that's true. And I don't know if you remember the movie Amadeus. With Salieri, he was talking to Amadeus and he wanted to seem snotty, so he rejected something that Amadeus had written and said it has too many notes. And I've had situations, on Much Music, where we would shoot something and then afterwards they'd say, well, it was supposed to be a minute. And I said, well, every other time before it was 2:30, so it was shot and conceived and everything at 2:30. And they'd say, well, it's supposed to be a minute. I said, well, you know what? Tell me where it starts to lag and I'll cut from there.
Yes.
What matters is not the length, but it's the same thing as buying something. It isn't so much the price, it's how much value are you getting? Right. And that's the same thing with content. The good thing about content, video content, is there are no formats that you have to fit. You don't have to do 22 minutes or 23 minutes or 48 minutes with breaks and every interval. You can do things. So when it stops being interesting and you've really exhausted all that you can get, you know, when you're mining an ore vein that isn't yielding any more ore, just get out of it. And I also tell them that when you're doing an interview, have questions prepared in advance, but be prepared to follow an answer that you get further in a direction that you hadn't planned, because you can't know what somebody's going to say, but you have to be able to be flexible enough and have the natural curiosity, which I think a lot of people don't have, is the natural curiosity and how to frame that curiosity in a way that interests other people. But you got to be able to say, to leap off of one answer and go in a direction you completely hadn't been prepared for.
Okay, you're going to love this then. Okay. This story comes out of that new world of walking away and doing my own thing. I used to interview this one guy all the time about a thing. And every time there was this thing, we'd call on this guy because he was a great interviewee. The thing is about great interviewees is great interviewees can sometimes only be great interviewees when they've got a great interviewer on the other side.
True.
So he and I had an excellent rapport. I managed to, get interesting tidbits out of this guy. And when he would go down a rabbit hole that wasn't interesting, I had the ability to pull him back out of it naturally in a way that wasn't uncomfortable. And we had a great back and forth. And so when I walked away, he's like, listen, you and I need to do something. And I took a meeting with him, and it was evident at the time that he was just basically looking for a vanity project. And so there was no money in it. I sort of set it aside. And sure enough, COVID comes along, and he comes back to me and says, listen, we really need to do something. So I sat down with him, and I came up with an idea for a show. And it was short and sweet, get in, get out. It was a high frequency because the content required it. And it was all mobile first. It was literally going to be a portrait mode based thing where people could consume this high quality yet short form content about how to handle the business world under COVID-19. And sure enough, we're at we're like moments away from making this a thing. And he says, oh, by the way, when I emailed you, I also emailed Yahoo. And I've got a meeting with them about a similar sort of thing. So I'll let you know how that goes. He takes my idea across the street. Yahoo greenlights his show. But it's always in execution. Ideas are a dime a dozen.
Oh, yes.
And so the execution was an absolute failure. Because one, it was long form content, not short form content. Two, it was working with a behemoth of an organization that isn't going to make him a priority. And three, it was with an interviewer who clearly wasn't listening to the answers to the questions to know what the proper follow-up question would be. So the interview comes across as 30 minutes of ping pong. Whereas you're explaining to these kids, go in with a set list of questions, but keep your mind open and keep your ears open to listen to the answers, because the best interviews don't come from knowing what questions to ask going into it, but knowing what questions to ask after you've asked the original questions.
That's exactly true. I always use the comparison that in war, no battle plan survives first contact with the enemy.
And right. Yeah, Muhammad Ali's got that line, everybody's got a plan until they get hit.
Yeah, exactly. And it's very, very true. It's very, and if you don't have a natural curiosity and an intellect capable of being quick in the moment and being able to formulate questions, if you're stuck on written questions, you're not going to be a good interviewer. It'll be almost comical because somebody gives you an answer and the audience is listening like, hey, that's interesting. Follow that through. And then you just go back to the question you had written down before. It's sometimes funny because it's so awkward, but it's not funny for the person who's doing it. It's certainly not their intention to be humorous. Now, when you started out your business, this is, I think, one of the things that's always difficult for entrepreneurs, besides the price problem and knowing how to price yourself. No, actually, we should go back to that. How should somebody figure out how to price themselves, especially if they're providing a service that isn't such a common thing, or, you know, that they can just go to somebody else's rate card. How do you figure out how to price yourself? Because I imagine it's per client you have to figure it out, because every project is completely different.
Not only is every project completely different, but every client is completely different. And I think one of the best lessons that I learned about pricing is that it's relative. That I've got clients that are global players on the world stage. They are international firms with a worldwide reach, and they can afford to pay more than the charity that is also a client of mine. So while both of them are getting very similar services from me, they are paying different prices because I can't possibly charge the charity what I'm charging the multinational corporation. So that was a bit of an interesting lesson for me to come to realize that there is no set pricing card for your services. And if you have a set pricing card for your services, you are most likely leaving money on the table. You are not putting it in your pocket. And a perfect example of that was I had a pitch that I was working on for a client, a potential client. And I got to the end of this slide deck, and my slide decks are insanely complex, like 34, 35 slides per deck.
Oh, you and me together.
Yeah, exactly. Like most slide decks are 9 slides, have way too much text on them, and are incredibly static, and they're boring. Mine are
incredibly
complex.
Stories. Yeah, they're not telling stories. They're just putting figures out there. I've had people tell me that for years. They used to tell me to do demo tapes. It shouldn't be more than 90 seconds. And I would make 7-minute ones. And people would watch them beginning to end. That's when I realized it depends on what the quality of the content is.
Precisely. So I realized that pricing power is variable depending on the client we're talking about. And the perfect example of that was I worked on this slide deck. And back to the whole point about you and me and, you know, not having the skill set for the discipline of the business. If I've got a meeting to talk about my pitch on a Friday at 9 a.m., you know I'm working on that pitch Thursday at midnight. Mm-hmm. But I'm definitely not working on it the Monday before. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so Thursday night, I'm working on this pitch. I put it all together. It's the way I want it. And I get to the money section, the price of this pitch section. And I put a dollar value down. And I'm like, you know what? That seems a little high. Instead of backspace, and changing the figure, I went to bed. And I got up the next morning and I looked at that figure again. And I thought, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to leave it at that figure. And sure enough, the client was like, we are more than happy with that figure. And had I reduced it out of my own Canadian bred insecurity and imposter syndrome, I would have left money on the table. My daughter would not have had, you know, a new pair of shoes kind of thing. All because I was insecure about myself, my value, and what I could provide to this client. Forgetting that these are multinational corporations. These are not even multinational corporations. These are just companies. They are accustomed to paying for a good or service. In broadcasting and media, you've spent your entire career being told your product or service can be easily swapped out for somebody else's product or service. You just don't have the headspace to price yourself properly.
It's interesting you say that, because also something I've learned, and I wish I'd learned from it better and actually stuck to it. But if you price yourself too low, then the potential customer thinks, A, you don't have confidence in yourself. And if you don't have confidence in yourself, why should they have confidence in giving you any money? And B, when something costs more, they tend to think that it's because it's going to be a better service. My grandmother, may she rest in peace, used to always buy the more expensive pot or pan because it had to be better because it was more expensive. And you have to find that sweet spot between something that is just so huge a number that people don't even want to negotiate with you, and a number that's too low. So they think this person doesn't have confidence in their abilities. So why should I? You've got to find that spot in the middle. And that's far easier said than done. And but I would say, if anyone listening, I think you made that point, which is that if you're leaning towards, if you're looking at a figure and saying maybe it's too high, well, if it's only maybe too high, leave it. Because a really serious company that's interested in your services will tell you, can we do anything about the price? If they're interested in the services. And then you can engage in a conversation. Any business that looks at the price and says no and just walks away, they weren't going to be anybody you wanted to work with anyways. It's not going to turn out nicely because they're not willing to be flexible and have conversations. And in this kind of business, you need to find a client that's willing to be flexible and have conversations.
That is so important. You're absolutely right. When you put that dollar figure down, you have to remind yourself that it's the business world. This is a world that is accustomed to negotiation. And if they look at that figure and they're more than likely to come back and go, you know what, it's just a little out of our price range. And then you negotiate. What I've also been doing is I've been doing what actually clients have asked for, which is they ask for what they call the Chinese food menu approach, where I do this 34 slide deck. And 33 slides are, look at this amazing, incredible project we can do together. And then the last page is split into three columns, which is column one is everything I just told you. Then everything I just told you, minus a few things. And then almost nothing I told you. And here are three prices. And what I found works very effectively, to your point about the emotional and the psychological association of price, is that if I say that the complete package costs a dollar, the second tier is 30 cents, and the third tier is a dime, they're going to go, wow, I don't want the dime. Who the hell wants the dime project? You know, and hey, this is the second one here, not good enough. I really need to pay the full dollar because I'm not getting enough if I pay the 30 cents or the dime.
Well, you know, the number of services that I've subscribed to online where you go in and it has that Chinese food menu and they let, you know, they tantalize you with all these things you could get at the higher price. And then, you know, a little less at the lower price and then even far less. I really think I need the things on that more expensive one. It's teasing. It's, you know, it's business by teasing in a sense. And, you know, and as in with a Chinese food menu, no substitutions. You know, you can say, okay, well, if you want to have the chicken balls with this less expensive plate, I can come up with a price that is the base price plus the chicken balls, for example. Be flexible, but more or less, you're right. The psychology of businesses is they don't want the least; they want the best.
Yeah, the thing too is one of the other lessons that I learned about pricing was when you are asked to do something you do not want to do. When you've pitched that project and they're like, oh yeah, that's great. We'd also like you to do this thing. How much more is it to also do this thing? I have learned that if you don't want to do that thing, you just price yourself out of the market on it. You make the cost of doing that thing you don't want to do so exorbitant that they're going to go, yeah, you know what? That's not worth it. Or the alternative, which has happened to me now every single time I've tried this technique, which is, yeah, okay, we'll pay that too. And now I'm like, oh fuck.
I know, now you're
now I have to do that thing.
But you're being compensated for the oh fuck of it. That's what
not only am I being compensated.
Fuck off price, right?
Right, exactly. But the beauty of the fuck off price is that if the client pays the fuck off price, you usually can afford to bring somebody else into the project to do it. That was one of the other great lessons about becoming an entrepreneur and doing my own thing, was the realization that if I have a stable of smart people who do a good job at that thing they do, then I can offload a lot of the things that need to be done to the people who do them better than me. So I am, just before COVID hit, I was this close to hiring a project manager, someone to do all those things and keep track of all those things that I didn't do very well and didn't want to do at all. I've got an accountant who handles almost every aspect of the numbers side of my life. And so if you overprice something and the client still says yes, well, now you just find someone who's willing to do the work for you and you take a cut of that.
That's very clever. We're talking about money, and one of the big challenges when you're setting up a business is, how do you come up with a business plan and figure out what your projected revenues are going to be when it's something that you haven't done before? And, you know, sometimes you have to go to the bank for financing and they say, what's your business plan? How do you come up with something and revenue projections when you have zero idea what those revenue projections are realistically going to be?
Well, you're asking the wrong person for that, because that's
we'll
not my
on.
World at all.
Let's move on.
Well, that was the reality of it, right? Is that the kind of work I do doesn't have a lot of overhead, generally speaking.
Right.
And any overhead it does have is covered by the individual client. So I've fortunately never had to go hat in hand to a bank looking for money. And one of the ways that this has worked out well for me is, and this may apply to other types of entrepreneurs and other types of businesses, but what's worked for me as a media studio is when I pitch a project, I don't spend a dime of my own money getting it up off the ground and running. Part of that pitch includes a pre-production budget of X number of dollars. And what that allows me to do is spend time doing the niggly little things, like the inordinate number of conference calls that any company is going to want. That was one of the big interesting culture shocks of moving from mainstream media. In mainstream media, decisions are made on the fly. They're made immediately. There's no time to stop. You just keep moving forward because it's a machine that needs to be fed constantly. You can't have dead air. And to go from a world where decisions are made on the fly, split second, at least the smaller ones, and then the bigger picture ones get made over the course of hours or days, to have clients go, yeah, in 3 weeks, can we have a conference call about this? I'm like, okay, yes. Sure.
Yeah.
You know, I could have it all done between now and 3 weeks if you really want, but sure, you know, we'll work at your pace.
Yeah.
That's the new phrase that pays for me is, do you have the bandwidth for this?
Uh-huh. Yeah. I've been hearing that quite a bit from people. It's something that always annoys me, to be honest with you, when somebody tells me I don't have the bandwidth for this. I'm thinking, can you find another phrase? Because that one's really annoying the shit out of me.
Well, what annoys me about that is that it's not even, as a geek, that's not even accurate.
It hits you on two levels.
Yeah.
it's true that it's very difficult to set rates. And it's true you have to work at the pace of your client. If you make them uncomfortable with, you know, your zeal, then they can go from being impressed with your passion to feeling annoyed and pushed, and you don't want that to happen. But I think that you can also agree that when you're coming up with an idea that may take some stretch of imagination for other people to you know, access your frame of reference, they almost never can. And so sometimes you have to come up with some kind of proof of concept or some kind of sample, which involves putting a little bit of work in advance. Because if you rely on other people to see your vision the way you see it, they can't. Because yes. They don't have your experiences. They don't have your frame of reference. They can't possibly see it the same way you do. So sometimes you have to create something tangible that they can look at so that they can wrap their head around it. Because otherwise you can talk, you can give the most detailed description you want, but that description is going to go through their filter and come out looking completely different than what you're describing. So sometimes it's best, I've always found that it's best to have a little bit of something to show them so that they're not conceiving of it incorrectly in their head in a negative way. I guess you have to think about, though, how much effort you put into it and how much time and resources you put into it.
Ah, well, see, that, 2 points on that. One, yes, I completely agree. One of the best lessons I learned, and I unfortunately, it took me a year and a half to learn it. I would send off PDF proposals after having, you know, the preliminary conversations. They'd be like, oh, that's excellent. Send us a proposal. And I would send a PDF document. I would wait 3 days and I would call them up. And what I learned was that you do not want somebody else to be responsible for understanding your vision. You
right.
must walk them through it every time. So the Zoom call thing under COVID-19 was perfect because what it did was it allowed me to fire up, you know, Apple Keynote, put together a 34-slide deck, and then hit share screen and walk people through my idea. And that was always so much better. But the second thing is, and to your point about having to come up with a concept or something that people can see or feel, something tangible, that's where the pre-production budget would come in. So when in a podcast environment, I would say, all right, so you want to do a podcast. Here's a pre-production budget. That's going to be used to hire the voiceover artist to do the show introduction, VO, to find the royalty-free music, to have all those conference calls that you're inevitably going to want to have. But I also need this money to build out this, that, or the other thing. And if it was a video thing, the pre-production budget would be substantially higher. I would bring my crew in. We would shoot a demo so that the client has a much firmer understanding of what I'm talking about. And that way, once they see that pre-produced demo, they can say, I like this, I don't like that, change this, add that. And that helps smooth over that conversation, that helps ensure that that relationship continues to grow, and it gives them a sense of what you're talking about without having to sign on the dotted line for the entire project. They're just signing on the dotted line for a pre-production budget to flesh out the idea.
Okay, but how do you get, and maybe there's no magic wand for this, but how do you get to the point where you've got the client interested enough in what you're describing to pay for creating something that so they can understand it? My experience has always been that either they're in or they're not in, and they're not going to pay me to come up with something so that I can pitch them with it again. So what's your secret?
The approach I've taken, if I was to sort of walk you through the path of going from not a client to a client to final product, would be the conversations generally start off very casual. They generally start off with me just trying to get an understanding of what's going on in that person's world. Mm-hmm. There's no way I can possibly comprehend it by reading all the internet. So could I please buy you a coffee, sit down, pick your brain, find out what's going on in your world? And invariably what happens over the course of that conversation is I learn what's working for them and what's not working for them. And I provide free advice because, as we've already discussed, ideas are a dime a dozen. It's the execution that's critical. So when you provide free advice, people are more likely to be ingratiated towards you and feel that you're someone that they can respect and trust. Because I'm not looking for something. I never end one of these conversations with, so how about I put together a proposal for you? Pow, 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 finger guns. And what ends up happening is by that soft relationship start, it leads to, you know what? We don't need anything right now, but I know this division of this big multinational corporation in which I operate that does. Or it's a, you know what, this is something that we've been thinking about. Let me get back to you. And invariably, there are follow-up conversations and questions. But that soft start leads to a hard signing on the dotted line down the road. But it's all because I've spent that time from the very beginning talking about what their problem is and what I see as their potential solution. So they've been in on the idea at the ground floor. And if you take that client through the journey of the idea from inception to execution, then not only are they more inclined to go, yeah, I like this idea, let's execute it, but you're more likely to get a product that they're happy with at the end of the day because their fingerprints are on it as well.
Exactly. Though, this is something that I sort of struggle with is that let's just say somebody's listening to what you've said and they're Joe Blow and they don't have a broadcasting background like you or I do, where people would know of our work already, which is already a huge thing when you're contacting somebody. But they contact someone and say, I want to find out about your business. You have time for coffee? What will compel or make somebody on the other end of the phone interested in talking to Joe Blow about their business? Like they're like, okay, why do I want to spend some time with you, Joe Blow? I don't know anything about you.
That is such a media guy question to ask.
Well, and I'll tell you why. I'm a media guy.
And I'll tell you why. Because the assumption here is multifold. One, the assumption is that the only reason why people are willing to take a coffee with me is because I was on TV.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it helps grease the wheels because they know you're a known commodity, so to speak.
Right. But the real reason why anybody takes a coffee with me or anybody else for that matter is business development and professional growth. Professional growth is something that media people have no idea exists in the real world. You go in every day, you do your job, you leave. The best case scenario, the boss comes out of the office and says, hey, great job on that thing. Worst case scenario, they don't, and then you get fired and you'd have no idea why.
Or they come storming out and say, what did you just say?
Oh yeah, that's my favorite. When someone sends a complaint email and the boss doesn't bother to go back and check the tape, they just assume that the listener complaint is accurate.
Yeah.
My favorite variation of that was I was talking about how the US President Barack Obama had a BlackBerry, but the problem was that it was insecure and that the spooks were telling him, we got to lock down your BlackBerry.
Right.
My boss comes to me and says, did you just call the US President a spook?
A spook, yeah. I knew where I was going.
He should have known
that. That's the danger with things that are race based, is that you wouldn't even have thought of making that connection because you're not racist. But there are racists out there, or people who are exceptionally racially sensitive, who do jump on that. You and I could trade stories back and forth about, though, considering the controversial and edgy nature of the stuff I did, the fact that we only received 3 complaints in 14 years is probably amazing. But
received 3 formal complaints to the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council. What you did not see was probably the flood of complaints that ended up in the inbox that the boss didn't have to deal with.
Oh, no, they didn't bother. That was the thing that always amazed them, is people aren't complaining about the things that you're saying, because it's kind of like they know what they're getting with the Ed the Sock character. They're either going to watch it because they want to or not. And there was one time, though, somebody said that one of the performers on the show called somebody else a Jew bag. And first of all, I've never even heard that term before. I think I don't even know what that is. And secondly, I'm Jewish. The producer working for me is Jewish.
And no alarm bells went off. So what's the problem?
We played back the tape and we looked at it. We don't know what she's saying there. It's kind of muffled, but it ain't Jew bag. Yeah. Everyone was walking around saying, what's a Jew bag? That's a new one.
The technology existed for the boss to, you know, go click, 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 pull up the video and know exactly what I did or did not say at exactly what time. Right?
Oh, exactly.
Didn't even put the effort into confirming the allegation before approaching me on it.
Yeah, those are always the fun people to deal with. I'm lucky that I've not really had to deal with people like this. Certainly City TV and Much Music. I never had anybody. The worst thing I ever had was did an interview with Christina Aguilera when she just released her first album. She was largely unknown. And driving home, I get a phone call from the VP, and he says, what did you say to Christina Aguilera? I'm thinking, what? What did I say to her? And because I do interviews and I'd forget about them 10 minutes later because I did so many. And I said, I don't know why. Well, what did you say to her? I said, I don't remember. We talked about her video, I think. Well, what did you say to her? I said, I don't remember. I said, why? He says, well, because we've been trying to get her to stay for the Much Music Video Awards and she'd been saying no. And after your interview, she said she would stay as long as she got to do another interview with you. I'm like, oh. the way he approached it sounded like I was in deep shit, and it turned out to be something else altogether.
Yeah, he didn't want you to feel good about a moment. He didn't want you to have an elevated sense of worth within the organization. He wanted to keep you in your place by not sharing critical information that would have helped you.
Well, he's always awkward in interpersonal conversations, so I sort of chalked it up to that, because I said, because if he wanted to make me not feel valued, that he went the other way, because he shouldn't have told me that she said she would only stay if I interviewed her.
I've always said that broadcasters make terrible managers, but the problem is yes. MBAs make terrible broadcasters. Broadcasters have spent their entire careers watching their boss kick garbage cans and yell and scream. Like, I witnessed a news director throw a stapler at a producer. What other industry could you get away with that? And that woman is still actively working today.
Oh, we could trade stories about people who should be working at a hot dog stand, but instead are actually still managing people that somehow manage to fall up, even though the results that they create are yeah. terrible. Or if they create good results, it's because the people under them made them look good.
Totally. Absolutely. So what ended up happening for me was that I came from a culture that was so stark in its contrast to the way the real world worked, that I went into lots of things with expectations that were not met. And it was a good thing. Things like, if I sent an email to you, if you and I were colleagues in a newsroom environment, and I sent an email to you and did not get a reply within 2, maybe 3 minutes, I'd get up from my desk, I'd walk over, and I'd stand next to you and go, excuse me, what's the answer? Whereas in the real world, you don't have to reply to an email for hours at an end. Sometimes all you have to do is say, I'll get back to you in 3 days. You know, it's just amazing to me that the sense of timing, the sense of compassion. We all talk about the heartless corporate environment, but until you've worked in broadcasting, you have no idea how heartless an industry can be.
It's not only heartless, there's not even a space in the chest cavity where a heart was supposed to go.
Right, exactly. Whereas in the traditional corporate world, all of these checks and balances have been put in place over the course of the last 150 years, you know, starting with the Industrial Revolution and the unions system and all of that kind of stuff. That infrastructure really doesn't exist in broadcasting. So your sense of self-worth, your sense of interaction with others, and the idea of professional growth are all things that were foreign to me when I walked away from my mainstream media career, and have been absolutely blown away that they actually exist in the real world.
Well, I think we've learned an awful lot. You know, there's a lot of information per square inch on this interview, and I think we'll have to have you back another time to talk about how you've managed to navigate the COVID environment, because this is, talk about, you know, physics being reversed. It's companies are holding on to their money. They're freezing their marketing budgets. So how to survive is probably a whole different series of shows. And I know that there'll be things we can learn from you, because you're a very smart guy. It's very clear from people listening to this interview that you're smart, you're savvy, you understand what needs to be done. You also understand when you're not doing it and what you need to get better at. And that's why I know that you're going to continue to be successful, and you're going to navigate these uncertain waters in a successful manner, because you're adaptable, you evolve, you understand the situation, and you move with it. And that's something we do learn when you're a broadcaster and you're on television live. You have to learn how to be able to sense the wave and either get out of the way or get on top of it. So I know that you're going to be giving us some valuable information in a later interview about how you managed to adapt your business model to suit this environment. And I look forward to hearing that. Michael, your company is Hainsworth.com Corporation?
That is the official title, yes.
Okay. And if the kind of services you provide are, well, you tell me.
It's the wide range of services. We do video services. We create entire platforms. My future rhythmic documentary platform that I developed for Nokia has video podcasting articles. We've got an editorial team. I do podcasting as white label as well for others, and the social media management for all of that kind of stuff. I've got a really smart group of people in my orbit that I draw on every day to make that possible. So anything tied to getting your story out is something that we as a team are capable of doing.
Okay. And to get in touch with Michael, how can they reach you? What's the best avenue?
Hainsworth.com is the website address, and there's a way to fill in a form on that. Or you just send me an email, michael@hainsworth.com, which is something that every time I give out my email address, people are like, huh? That's your email address? Yes. firstname@lastname.com. I've had it for 30 years now. I am a huge geek.
All right. Was your first site hosted on GeoCities?
It's funny you should say that. That's the gag on the Geeks and Beats podcast, that we've got 1.4 billion listeners on iTunes and GeoCities, something that hasn't existed for more than a decade.
Well, you're not listing your MySpace site?
Exactly.
All right, Michael. I really appreciate you sharing your experience, your wisdom with us. I'm sure that there's entrepreneurs out there, or people who would like to become entrepreneurs, who've gotten a lot out of the experience and wisdom that you've gotten out of just continuing to do what you do. So thank you for your time and for your input. And I look forward to talking to you again, and best of continued success with Hainsworth.com Corporation.
Thank you so much for your kind words and for your interest.
Thank you, Michael.
Ultimately, look, I'm the guy that had the impossible dream and the impossible ideas, that was fortunate enough to be granted an ear by some of the most incredible studios that were out there, and together recognized that there was a product here. Maybe they themselves didn't understand it, and maybe neither did I, and it evolved. It sort of came into itself. So, you know, yes, we did all the work, but you know, a break comes, you either create the break or the break presents itself. You just have to recognize it and take it. There's a lot of, just don't be arrogant about it. There's nothing wrong with believing yourself. And sometimes, you know, an overinflated ego can come across as conceit. I'm guilty of that too. But being able to, understanding that you have something, it's a real thing. Like, to me, I could feel that there was something here. I just needed somebody to listen. And fortunately, I got that. And, you know, then once we had one or two studios, we now had credibility. right? So I could pick up the phone and call another student and say, look, we do this with these guys, that with these guys. I'm really interested in this brand. Let's have a chat. You know, what do you think? Blah, blah, blah. And it just became more interesting. And then suddenly I realized when I was making these calls, yeah, you do replicas. Yeah, yeah, we know what you're doing. So how do you, and suddenly they're saying, how do you feel about this? And how do you feel about that? Before I'm even talking about it. So much respect to all of the studios and, you know, these things, they all come and go in waves. So right now we're working with certain studios, not some of the others. And it all has to do with moments and timing and all of that. And I just look forward to the time that we're working with, you know, all of them again. And it just, the amount of creative freedom that you have when you look at, particularly where, look at what Marvel's done with the Avengers and all of their characters on film. Look at the DC universe. Look at, there's so much still that we want to do, be it from a replica motorcycle suit standpoint to accessories like purses and sneakers. And it's not just a brand. I mean, if you look at our Batman sneakers or the Flash sneakers, it's not just a running shoe with a lightning bolt on it. We've built the whole suit textures into the running shoes and all of that. I mean, it has to, again, we look at the emotional connection. So design is important, all of that. But in the beginning, there was a bit of a blind faith. I was naive. There was a lot of that. But, you know, as long as you stick to your guns and aren't afraid to learn along the way, and I was a sponge. To me, it was, why am I not in that group of people who are having those conversations if I know for a fact I'm outselling them but I'm still not under their radar? Why? You have to be able to understand that you need to grow. Regardless of what you're doing, you need to grow into a company that's going to want to continue to grow. You got to be hungry, and it has to be insatiable, basically.
Well, and you have been, and your success has been very inspirational. And I think people can learn a lot from, you know, what you've built, because you've described times when you were faced with challenges, like when your twins were born, and when you like sort of basically, holy shit, we have to make this work. Those, when they're actually happening, they feel a lot longer than just how you related them to us today, which I think is part of the entrepreneurial mindset, which is that you have to be able to focus on the positive and put aside the negative in order to be able to be successful. If you focus too much on the negative, you're your own worst enemy. You know, you're always looking for reasons why it's not going to work, so you can find a reason to justify you giving up, whereas you use that as a launching pad to go forward. And everyone has to know for themselves when they've got a proper sense of this is going to work or it's not going to work. And I think what you said about you just had a feeling, you just could feel that this was something that was going to work. I think entrepreneurs feel that. I'm sure everybody who's listening to this who's been an entrepreneur, is an entrepreneur, or is thinking of becoming one, they understand that feel in your gut when something feels right and you can't really quantify why. And it's basically your brain is synthesizing a whole bunch of information that you've absorbed and coming up with a calculus that, hey, this could work. That's the essence of being an entrepreneur. It's that risk, but it's not a stupid risk in your mind. You have thought things through. You've obviously been attracted to reading things and absorbing things. And that's what makes that gut feeling that I know this can work. Did you ever at any point, and if this is too private, feel free to say so, but did you ever at any point have to go to relatives or to the bank, wherever, for financing, for help? And if so, what advice would you give people who have to do the same thing?
Of course we did. You know, right from the beginning, all of this involved capital. And it was capital we didn't have, okay? So, and throw on top of it, we just had two brand new babies. And we were first-time parents. So we didn't have the capital. We didn't have anything. So yes, we had to look at financing from the bank. And it was all on a whim and on a prayer. So we had to go to the bank and say, look, we've secured this type of contract and we're forecasting these kinds of, and it's crazy, but once upon a time, I had never used language like we're forecasting these kinds of sales. We're looking at this type of of profit. We're looking at a loss of, or we're looking at potentially returned or damaged goods in this particular. These were not, this wasn't vocabulary that I was using at all. Back then it was like, hey, is this cool? All right, you want to buy? Come in. Awesome. Okay. That was the language, you know, and suddenly I was thrown into this world where, and look, I don't want to sound like I had an epiphany. I felt very comfortable in it, but it just wasn't, it wasn't language that I had regularly used. So, you know, yes. So of course we had to go for financing, and it quickly ballooned and inflated because nothing is ever, at least for us, it wasn't the way we had forecasted. And because we weren't seeing incredible numbers from the first group of jackets that we had done. Again, they were selling okay, but they weren't funding anything. And at the same time, I had stopped making all of the previous products through Universal Design. So we had no other source of income. We put all of our eggs into this basket, okay? Which we can debate whether it was the right or wrong idea, but it took all of my emotional and physical time to build the company. I had, my head was nowhere else there. Not only, and you recall what the basement was like, it was set up as a sculpture and mold making studio. Mm-hmm. I had to gut everything and throw everything out so that once the product started to ship in from overseas, we had, so I was receiving all of this in my garage. We had made a slide on our staircase and we were throwing the jackets down the slide one by one. And I was stacking them up in my basement by size. And we're talking 500, 600, 700 jackets at a time, each one weighing minimum 11 pounds, maxing out at 18.5 pounds, depending on the size. So this was a real thing. There was no way for me to run the previous business, at least not. I would have already had to get another location, and I wasn't ready for that. So it was, it was a surreal time. It was a lot of just go and do it. It's going to work. It's going to work. The numbers are coming. It's happening. But it took a while. It took a good 9 months before we saw, what month is August?
The eighth month. I know that's my birthday in that month.
There you go. So by August, I think it was when we went live with the Dark Knight suit. That's when we were like, okay, you know what? It looks like we've got something. And this was the first time we had started seeing even sales numbers quite like that on a daily basis. Rima would call me up and she would say, look at what's happening here. Holy cow. And I was like, awesome. Great. All right. Now let's make sure that next week we have even a little bit more. And I was really saying that to myself because I was the face. I was the one who's out there pushing or pimping, whatever the term is. So it was trade show after trade show. And let's get out there because the pictures are great. But the minute people see this and can try one on, it's a whole other ball of wax. The internet, the Motorcycle Super Show, that's the first weekend in January here in Toronto every year. We did that show a few years ago now, 2 years in a row. The first year when I did it, I called up the show, 1 or 2 months before. Hey, Universal Designs here, or UD Replicas. I'd like to talk about getting a booth space. All right, what do you do? I said, well, we make motorcycle suits. Yeah, we got a lot of motorcycle suit guys already. You know, try back next year. So, well, hold on. Ours are, you know, we do the Batman. And he says, the what man? So we do the Batman suits and, you know, the stormtroopers. And he said, what are you talking about? And he literally laughed in my face when I said Batman motorcycle suit. He goes, you ride that on a Harley? And I said, well, yeah. As a matter of fact, our model, who models all of our suits, actually, you know, has a Harley. And if you don't mind, I'd like to park his bike in the booth. And he goes, wait a minute, hold on a second. What the hell? And I think his words were, what the fuck are you trying to pull? So we get the booth space and we go in and set everything up. Peter is his name. And he showed up and he was riding around a bicycle on the whole floor as everybody's setting up. And he comes to me and he goes, David. I said, yeah. And he goes, so you weren't shitting me. This is Batman. Now, this is the day of setup. So I'm guessing it's the day before the doors open, okay? Mm-hmm. Sunday is the last day, okay? Sunday, he comes up to me and he goes, and he brings me an application for next year. And he goes, and he hands it to me. He goes, this is next year's application. And I said, well, okay, I'll look at it. And he goes, no, Dave, listen, I'm sick of this bullshit. People are coming to the box office or the booth to buy the ticket. And they say, is this where we can see the Batman suit? So I did sign for the next year. And he put us right in the center floor. He goes, you're an attraction. You're literally bringing people. So he put me right at the front. So
that must have felt great. I mean, this is something that came out of your head, and you had the internal confidence to push forward. And Rima was great in supporting you. And here you were being validated. You know, this wasn't a crazy idea. Yes, this can bring money. Yes, I can make a living with this. I mean, you know, moments like that, when you realize, holy shit, I was just a kid with a dream, and I kept pushing forward, and look at this, people are taking it seriously, and it's something people really want. And when you get that validation, that's, you don't have many of those moments in your life. So you have to treasure those when they come, and that had to have been a great moment. And you've had many of those moments, because you've continued to press on. You say you're a small company. Sure, you're small in the number of people you employ, so, you know, and so on. But you're not a small company. You're playing with the big boys. You're playing with Lucasfilm. You're playing with Warner Brothers. You're playing with Marvel. You're playing with DC. My Little Pony, you did. It shows the range of the products you're able to produce. And this is why I wanted to have you on this inaugural episode, because as much as I've done stuff following my dreams where people laughed at me, my best friends laughed at me when I said I wanted to be in television, you have inspired me with the stuff that you've done and how far you've gone. You provide a great example for people. So I'm glad that you've taken the time to share that with us today.
Well, Stephen, thank you. I'm gonna add something that you may or may not know. Obviously, I have. First of all, I didn't know this was the inaugural episode, so this is quite an honor. I was strategic in wanting to get under your radar and Leanna's radar when I was starting out. Even with Universal Designs, I would watch your show in the evenings. Huge fan, and then when I would see you guys at the conventions, whatever ones they were at the time, Paradise or Toronto Comic Con, I forget, whatever it was. Point is, I was, you're part of that. When I say, why am I not part of that group? I was referring, and partly at the time now, to you. Why am I not with them? Why am I not rubbing elbows with their successful? They have a TV show and they're comic book geeks and all of that. And we should be doing something together. So it was important for me to get to know you guys. And then it's one of those things, you know, there's that funny expression, never meet your heroes because you never know if they're assholes and right. All of that. And not only did we get a chance to meet and we got a chance to do some cool things together, but you guys turned out to be great people and I consider you guys great friends. So it's sort of one of those win scenarios where there's people who have worked hard and I can absolutely, this whole interview is absolutely relatable to you when you think, well, what must it have been like for you starting out? You're going to put a sock on your hand and start making people laugh and this and that. So, you know, yours is even a further stretch than mine. These are both things that only you or I and the people who truly believe in us could have seen and understood as something that really existed as a product or as a business or as a thing. So, you know, we can easily identify in each other in that respect. So it is absolutely a thrill for me and I'm absolutely grateful for being part of this.
Well, I look forward to your continued success and I look forward to having you back again to talk about the new successes that you've had. And I want to thank you, David Pei of UD Replicas, Universal Designs, Kiss Costumes. You're now doing costumes that are amazing. I have to say, I've seen them up close. The Kiss costumes are unbelievably great. I mean, your work just keeps getting better and better, I guess, as you learn more and more. And Kiss Costumes is active now. And you guys are, I mean, to get to work with Gene Simmons, who does not suffer fools and does not, you know, he doesn't equivocate on people who provide quality. He will only work with real people, with real professionals. So that's a feather in your cap. And people can find you online. Where are the various places?
We have for the superheroes and the movie replica items, it's udreplicas.com. Mm-hmm. And if it's Kiss related, so it's rock and roll, then you're looking at kissreplicas.com. So it's very simple. UD Replicas and Kiss Replicas.
.com. Okay.
.com. David. Yeah. Kissreplicas.com. Yes. Yes.
David Pei, thank you very much for sharing your story with us today and sharing the inspiration that people will take from your words and from your successes.
Much appreciated, Stephen. Thank you so much.
And thank you guys for listening. I'm Stephen Kersner, and we'll be back with another tale of somebody who did something crazy and made it work on our next episode.
This is fun! The FU Network!